with our very special guest tonight, Dr. Claude Swanson, as we talk about life force. And we'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Back to Oris for a moment, Claude. Edgar Cayce, yeah, as he was getting into an elevator many years ago, spotted a group of people. He always can read auras. He didn't see any around them. It frightened him, scared the heck out of him. He backed up. He did not go down the elevator. That elevator cable snapped. Those people all died.
Yep.
Unbelievable story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, if you can read it, go with it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And, one of the early pioneers in Western studies of subtle energy was named Baron von Reichenbach back in the 1840s and 50s. He spent several decades studying subtle energy, and he found people who were, he called sensitives, who could see the energy around people, and did many, many studies with how this energy behaved. And it's one of the foundational pieces of science for how we have these rules about this energy. But he made this comment that if we could see, if all of us could see this energy, the aura around us, we would be at a much higher level of behavior toward each other and a higher level of consciousness, because we would all act differently if we could perceive the energies in each person. So I totally agree with that.
Back to the Princeton Pear Lab, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research. Now, that's closed now, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Why'd they close? Funding? What happened?
I think so. I'm not really up on the details. I think they've started some new venture elsewhere, but I don't know a lot about what that's called.
I know the laboratory's founder, Robert Jean,
right,
said, this is a great quote, "If people don't believe us after all these results that we've produced, then they never will."
Yeah, exactly. I know. I mean, that they practice pure science. That is what science is supposed to be about. You take the data, and if the results come out different from your theory, then you should change the theory. They have the data.
Long distance healing. How far can you heal?
There seem to be no limits. We've certainly have examples of 10,000 mile distances for long distance healing. And it's not just healing, it's also various forms of PK. Some of these same Qigong masters who can heal at those great distances have also demonstrated they can change the radioactive decay rate of radioactive materials. They can deflect laser beams. And they can change the properties of water. So this ability seems to work not just for healing, but for a wide variety of phenomena where we're changing the physics.
Claude, how important is the recipient's belief in all of this?
I don't think it's important because a lot of these experiments, there's an inanimate object, a decaying americium-237 or something, some source that is doing the decaying. We also have experiments such as Bengston's, where he took skeptics and taught them a procedure by which they were sent energy to little mice in cages, never allowed to touch the cages, though. And, of course, the mice didn't understand belief, and yet he found this was a very effective means of healing. One of the interesting side effects is that he discovered that if you place a mouse that has been given cancer in an area where you have been doing healing on other mice, just the proximity of the first mouse causes the healing rate to be much higher than you would expect. So there's a proximity effect from healing.
You mean just if he got in that range, that energy is still there, it would help him.
Exactly. That's right.
God, that's something else. I'm going to tap into you for physics for just a moment.
Okay.
Is it safe to say that the laws of physics are always the same no matter where it is in the universe, no matter where we are?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the laws. I mean, if by the laws you mean that you will take into account differences in place to place, then they're the same. But if you don't take into account the differences in different regions of space, then they'll be different. And that's one of the things I believe that we're seeing, astronomers talk about dark energy and dark matter, areas where it seems like, there's extra gravity, and yet we can't find the matter that's causing it. Other places where there's a repulsion, where things are being pushed apart, and they can't explain why that can happen at all. But it turns out that subtle energy, this exact force that the Russians call torsion, does have that effect. It has two polarities. One pushes things away. One pulls them toward. And it appears to exist very naturally in the vacuum of space. And therefore, you would expect there'd be patches with more of one or more of the other. Not only that, but it turns out that the like energies attract more of the same. So it's not like electromagnetism, where opposites attract. This is the same attracts. So if you have an area of space with more of the right-handed spin, it will attract more of the same. So you would expect to find space to be somewhat lumpy with areas of dark energy and areas of dark matter. So this is an interesting theory that is coming out of the subtle energy work, but appears to have application for cosmology on the cosmic scale. And now if you go to some of the observations, like Richard Hoagland, Wilcox talking about evidence that we're seeing anomalous heating of planets in the solar system. And how can that be? Well, if we're going into a region where the relative background energy of the right-handed versus left-handed spin, the torsional spin, the chi, is different in the background, that will cause effects of exactly this type.
Who came up with all this? For it to all work, to fit like a puzzle.
Well, I think a lot of credit goes to a man named Nikolai Kozarev, who was an astrophysicist who came up with the idea of torsion in the 1950s. He was obsessed by the nature of time. Now, what is it? He had spent 13 or 14 years in Stalin's gulag in the 30s, so he had a lot of time on his hands. He also
too much time, probably.
Well, I think it did him some good.
Yeah.
But he also got to know the shaman in the Altai Mountains area in Russia, and they gave him a different perspective. I think they helped him to look with the intuitive perspective much better. So he came up with a lot of these ideas, and he began testing them first on his own, then other scientists began testing them. By 1970, when Sheila Ostrander and Lynn Schroeder were over there writing their book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, they spent an entire chapter interviewing him. And by that point, he was already accepted and admired in Russia for his discoveries. After that, it's pretty clear from other scientists that at least 20 years of large government programs went on, further testing this work. It's amazing that all this has happened, and yet in America, we know nothing about it.
Tell me a little bit about torsion field physics.
Okay. I will tell you as best I can understand.
Yeah, I was going to say, make sure we can understand.
Yeah, well, I'll do that too. One of the difficulties is that these programs probably may have been classified programs in Russia, okay, back during that time period. We don't really know exactly, but what we do know is that when Glasnost and Perestroika broke out in 1991 or so, the papers came flooding out. A lot of the scientists suddenly were out of work, and they began appealing to the West, and there was a whole opening of information. And that's how we know as much as we do. A lot of those papers have never been translated into English, however, so we only have a fraction of the information. So one of the reasons it took me so long to write this book is that I had to really fit the puzzle pieces together from every possible source I could find and do the best I could, and I may still find there's some pieces missing when it's all said and done. That being said, the model appears to be that in the vacuum of space, there's two types of energy waves that travel through, that propagate. One spins to the right, one spins to the left. They have to do with conserving angular momentum. Every object which spins has angular momentum. The Earth has angular momentum. electrons and protons do. It appears that whenever one of those changes its direction of spin, it flips its spin into some other axis, that creates a torsion wave, which then propagates through space. So torsion waves are created by changing of spins.
And what changes the spin?
Well, it could be interaction bumping into another particle would do it, for example. Electromagnetic forces will also do it. If you have an electron, you hit it with an electromagnetic wave, you accelerate the electron. When you accelerate it, you also cause its spin to change. So electromagnetism actually creates torsion.
Doesn't Venus spin the opposite way that we do?
Could be. I don't know the details on that. But the bottom line is that torsion waves are present everywhere in space, and they're constantly affecting particles at the very small levels. So, there's very little energy in a torsion wave compared to electromagnetism, which is one of the key ingredients, but they carry information. So it's a whole new area of science that we really need to get caught up on.
Why would it be important to the study, for example, of what you're doing, the synchronized universe, of life force?
Well, one of the things, it appears that if you look at the deepest level in what goes on in particle physics, you'll probably find the torsion particles and these spin exchanges probably to be the most important, the deepest process going on. In a way, I think of it as making up the fabric of space. So electromagnetism and the quantum effects actually occur at a higher level. Experiments seem to indicate that these torsion waves travel faster than light. They may have two components that travel at light, going forward and backward in time, and then a combination that travels at infinite speed. What we do know is the Russians have built telescopes that are designed to detect this torsion energy, and they find that you get an image of the sun at the place you would see it in the sky, which is what took 8 minutes for the light to get here.
Right.
You also see the two other positions, one where you would see it if light were traveling backwards in time, a different position in the sky, and you get a third position, which is its exact instantaneous position, as though light traveled with infinite speed.
So they basically see it three times.
Three images of it in the torsion image. So torsion has some very special properties that make it great for communication. If you want to talk to somebody on Mars, you don't want to wait, 20, 30 minutes or however long
right.
it takes. If you have a signal that can propagate much faster, you'd probably like to use it. Well, the Russians have already built communication systems with torsion waves. They patented them.
My gosh, have we done anything like that here?
Not that I'm aware of.
Could this be used for time travel?
There are Russian scientists who are attempting to build machines. Well, they've built them, in fact. Because the torsion waves have an effect on time, one wave pushing you forward in time, one pushing you backwards, they built little chambers where you send waves of just one polarity into the chamber to build up a concentration, and they found that time can either slow down by a couple percent or speed up by a couple percent. And there are a lot of implications for life forms, that they have seen some of the animals die because of this whole quandary that there are many possible futures, but they want to go backwards in time. Trying to repeat that path can be tricky. So they're already encountering some of those quandaries involving time travel, even though they're right now still talking about a few percent change.
But you're saying the Russians are trying to work on some kind of time travel apparatus.
They have built them, and they have reported on them. And Chernobrov is the principal person I'm aware of who has written about
it. Do you think they really have this?
Well, I believe they really built these things, and I think their capabilities are limited to a couple of percent. I don't know beyond that what's possible.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
Got to start somewhere, right?
That's dramatic.
Yep.
It's too bad we're so far behind and stuff like that.
Yep.
Yeah. I know you've done some work with Stan Romanek.
Mm-hmm, yes.
I want to preface that and then get your take on him.
Okay.
We had him on the program with his incredible story
mm-hmm.
of an alien peering through a window
mm-hmm.
Of his daughter's room. And he set up a camera and he got this video of this bizarre looking creature.
Mm-hmm.
We brought him on the program and then he agreed to take a polygraph test.
Mm-hmm.
We hired a polygraph examiner, certified examiner,
mm-hmm.
who did the test with Stan. Stan was willing to do it and he did it. And we hired a polygraph examiner out that way. Colorado, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the polygraph examiner said he failed the test.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Stan, in Stan's defense, he claims that he had taken heavy sedation and it affected him and he didn't like the polygraph examiner or the questions, but that's his side of it.
Mm-hmm.
The polygraph examiner stands by his story about the little alien and that he didn't believe Stan was telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what Stan said,
mm-hmm.
Where do you come in with this?
I got to know Stan because I lived in Colorado. I lived in Colorado Springs, I think, around the same time when he did, and then I also was in Northern Colorado when he did, and I gave a lecture there, and some people said, "Well, boy, you should get to know Stan Romanek because he is getting equations in some of his encounters," and so that's when I first heard about him. And it was probably, I took my time in getting to know him better because with anything like that, I like to kind of understand the people involved and get a sense of them. So it was probably a kind of a year before I got closer involved with the case. But I got to know Stan and his wife and children pretty well. And I would say to the extent of being friends. And I believe he's honest. I believe that's just my assessment of him
sure.
as a person. And then I began looking at some of the equations, and I found I could learn things from the equations. And that's one of the of my tests. If you expect you're dealing with a superior race, you hope they'd have something intelligent and interesting to say. And I found his equations to be interesting and helpful. And I know Stan well enough that he didn't invent them. You know, he could not come up with these things. In fact, I just recently figured out one of the other equations that was kind of lingering, the backwards equation, the last week or so. I think I understand what that's about, too. But what I find the case credible, and I have taken polygraphs, too, and I don't do well on polygraphs. I'm
a
very nervous person, and I have an active imagination, and I don't, you know, I can understand why people can fail polygraphs, so I don't. You know, I wouldn't write him off based upon just
yeah.
that.
Well, a lot of people I've talked to who know him all attest by him
mm-hmm.
and, you know, claim he's an honest guy, a good guy. And, you know, and I'm not questioning that at mm-hmm. all. I'm just saying the results are he didn't pass that test.
Right. And I think for me, beyond all of that, I mean, I've studied enough things that, you know, I don't have to see a UFO to believe in them. Okay. Because
right.
I have enough evidence on other forms. However, the second and third UFO I ever saw in my life, I was standing next to Stan Romanek.
Amazing. How about that? How about that? Claude, I want to talk with you about some examples of subtle energy and some of the people who use this
okay.
and have you comment on that. It's a fascinating story. In our final hour, we'll open up the phone lines, questions with Dr. Claude Swanson, and also perhaps share some of your stories. Like the one that I got several years ago when the two cars were ready to collide and they went through each other with not a scratch on the car or the occupants of the vehicles. We'll be back in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM with Dr. Claude Swanson. His latest work is called Life Force. We'll be back. Final hour of the program tonight. Mark Zakri joins us. We'll talk about sci-fi, a little bit about the Twilight Zone as well. And when we come back, we'll be chatting more with Dr. Claude Swanson. And next hour, we'll take your phone calls and your stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Claude John Swanson, our special guest right here on Coast to Coast, author of Life Force. Claude, let's talk a little bit about these subtle energy practitioners, how they got to where they are and what they do. And, of course, one of the big names is John of God in Brazil. What do we know of him?
He's been in practice in Brazil for decades. And he's quite famous at this point. There's a small town called Abajania, which is a couple hours outside of Brasilia, so it's in the internal part of Brazil, and hundreds of people come every day to be healed there. And I had friends who'd been down there when years ago and had amazing, very positive experiences with him, but I didn't know what to expect. And he's the overall format is fairly religious. He's what they call a spiritist, which is a movement that is centered in Brazil. People who allow spirits to take over their bodies during their ceremonies. And in his case, about 31 different departed priests, monks, doctors, a lot of whom, I think most of whom are known, their identities are known. They take over his body during the healing. And what happens is he doesn't have to be able to see the person. He doesn't have to really be able to touch them. The spirits supposedly do all the work, but he does many what he calls visible operations. He'll take a kitchen knife or a scalpel or some crude instrument and work on them and do things that would normally kill a person or give them some horrible disease
right.
if the people get well. So there's a track record now of hundreds of people per day for many, many years that supposedly, in many cases, miraculous healings. Now, he doesn't say that everyone is healed. In fact, we know that everyone is not healed who goes there. What he says is that it has to do with their own karma, their own life path, that the disease itself is a form of learning. And if you heal someone without them learning the lesson, they'll get something else.
They say he's treated up to, indirectly and directly, 15 million people during the past 40 years. 15 million, Claude.
Yep, yep. If you look at the rate they go per day, it seems possible to me. When I went down there, I'd been on Art Bell. You know, Art interviewed me years ago.
Right.
And asked me that question. He said, if you had some terrible illness, what would you do? And I said, I'd go take it to Brazil. And he cross-examined me on this pretty closely, and some lady called in who had some skeptical things to say about John of God, and I could not really answer her because I didn't have, you know, enough. I didn't have any direct experience. And then Art led on as how, is it his sister or his daughter? I forget which is down there and lives there. That's what he said at the end of the interview, which was, you know, another surprise. Anyway, so I thought after that I better get some more evidence before writing about him in my book. So I spent about 3 weeks down there. The first thing you notice is that before you go, if you check on the internet, there are all kinds of terrible stories, which, you know, would make you decide never to go. I went ahead anyway, and the first intimation I had is something was not as the stories had portrayed. Is in the taxi drive into the village, I went through a wall of energy, and I am not very sensitive to energy. I didn't know that such things existed, but after you go through one, you know they exist. And it was like I'm sitting in the taxi, and all of a sudden, everything gets quiet. There's this wonderful, sweet, loving energy in the air. And I felt kind of like my idea of what heaven might be. I mean, it was a very pleasant feeling. And that feeling remained with me for the 3 weeks that I stayed in Abajania. And I learned later, well, I have a friend who tried to visit me. She was very adept at going out of body. She tried to go out of body from Tucson on three different occasions. And she says, I don't know what it is. I'm usually good at this, and I keep bouncing off. I can't get in. And I asked people there, and they all nodded and said, well, yeah, there's an energy shield around Abajania to keep spirits out, because people who are there being healed have their chakras open the whole time they're there. They don't want spirits coming in and interfering. So, you know, this stuff, and then the last piece of that, well, there are two more pieces of my experience. Number one, when I was staying there, I would interview people, dozens of people, ask about their stories, and I found an awful lot of them, a high percentage, had some kind of miraculous story to tell about things that have happened to them, being cured of incurable diseases, et cetera.
Remarkable.
And then the last piece was when I had my own one before John of God, I didn't have much that I knew that was wrong, but I said, well, you know, do whatever. And they sent me for an operation, an invisible operation, which means the spirits. I didn't think anything happened. Went back to my room, and I collapsed on the bed, was unable to move for 24 hours.
Wow, you exhausted?
I wasn't tired. I mean, I had not been tired. There's no reason why I should be tired. But this is apparently what happens to everyone who has an invisible operation. They collapse on the bed. They lie pretty much stationary for a day. And meanwhile, I could feel sharp little fingers or instruments in my abdomen. And it was not fun. And I kept trying to... I don't sleep on my back normally. I roll on my side.
Yeah.
I could not do that. It hurt too much. I had to lay on my back. And I kind of felt that, okay, the spirits are telling me that they're real. They're like proving it to me. And if I don't feel it, they'll poke harder. So I kind of got it in the end. And I know it's a strange and remarkable feeling if you haven't been through it, but it was like, you know, the spirits run this place. And I get it now. So that's my take on John of God.
How does it work? What's he tapping into? How's he doing it?
Well, I think we're in a time, and obviously there have been earlier times when this is true too, where we have to recognize that spirits are real, they exist, and they can affect things in the physical world. And part of this, as a scientist trying to understand it, I would say, well, it's the torsion field, which has aspects of consciousness about it. It's a non-linear field which can hold together and form conscious beings. So spirits can be made from a torsion field of the right type. So that's as a scientist. But the bottom line is that everything is not matter, and matter does not tell the whole story about what's out there.
Do you believe that these people have a gift from God or just knowledge of use?
You mean someone like John of God?
Yes.
I would say that their access comes from a much higher level of wisdom than I'm able to judge. So if they say it's God, that's fine with me. You know, these higher levels of spirit, I'm convinced that they exist, and it's a level that I can't really, you know, I would have to be at that level to understand it, you know. If you can't do it, then it's unlikely that one has that level. So I think I can't really explain beyond that. I mean, we're kind of in an area here where science starts to fizzle out. We've kind of gone about as far as we can go at the moment. But it seems as though they have a contract with the spirits, and where the spirits work through them, and they are a vessel, but that, as John of God has said, he doesn't have to do the operations. He could just say, you're all healed. You know, or as far as I'm concerned, I would say, well, the spirits are probably actually doing the work anyway. But he is sort of there as a meeting place or intermediary. And I'm sure there are people who understand this far better than I do. So, you know, I'm kind of beyond my level of competence here.
Well, but at the same time, you're astute enough to know that there's more to real science than meets the eye.
Yes, and I think maybe one of the best tools that I have, and we all have, is our feelings, which is part of our intuition, you know. And it's a certain feeling, just like when you go into a sacred space, you go to a place that has a very special energy, you can tell. And maybe we don't know quite why it has that level of energy, why it affects us, but we can tell that something's special. And that's what I was aware of.
Claude, who is Mohandri Trivedi?
He is an Indian that I came to know last year through Professor Rustam Roy at Penn State. Rustam Roy is the Pew Professor of Material Science. He's sort of one of the founders of material science almost in America, a big program, 1,000 papers. And he's also of Indian heritage, as is Mr. Trivedi. And he began working with him and got verification of certain abilities, the ability to change water so that Raman backscatter spectra were altered and things like that. And he also became aware of these other experiments that Trivedi was doing in India over a 10 or 12 year period, working with agricultural colleges, causing changes in crops. One of the classic cases was a spongy tissue disease, where mangoes look beautiful on the outside, but inside they can have their pulp can have a spongy quality, could be bitter, and be, you know, you can't sell them. And so they did an experiment with Mr. Trivedi, and you take half the field, we'll take half the field. We'll take half the field and treat it the way we normally do, fertilizer, et cetera. For Trivedi's half, he just did a blessing, for about a four-minute blessing. For the next 4 years, his side of the field had no spongy tissue disease.
For 4 years?
Yes. Still amazing. Ongoing, I understand. Higher vitamin C quality, several percent more mass, heavier fruit, etc. The same thing was done, the same type of thing was done with cashews with similar effect. So there have been a variety of them, like 40 different plant species that they've tested, and they've all come up with effects of this type. So he's actually in America now, and you know, looking for a scientist, I think, to do experiments with. I think that's what's really needed now. I think for me, he's an unusual case, because most of the yogis who go through normal yoga training, it's a much more spiritual oriented path, and they usually will not work with scientists. Mr. Trivedi did not go through the yogic training, but seems to have been given a message or a some kind of spiritual guidance that this is what he's supposed to be doing. And so hopefully the only caveat here is that when someone has abilities of this type and we don't know exactly how they got them, that they could also lose them anytime. So we don't know how long this will continue, but at least for the moment, it's a very interesting case, an opportunity for scientists to look at the power of consciousness.
Do you find that these practitioners are generally good people, or have you ever stumbled across any of them that one would call pure evil?
Fortunately, I've never stumbled across a person of that description, but I do acknowledge that the ability to have PK powers or to affect things around us seems to be something that exists both in good people and people that are not so good. In fact, I just heard a story today from my cab driver that would be an example of that. I don't know if you want to hear it or not.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, he was
temperate, of course. Children are listening.
Well, yeah, I know. he was working with some Mexican laborers. They were picking fruit, I think. I've kind of forgotten the details here, but he has quite an interest in the paranormal himself, and for some reason, he began telling them that he was basically a Mexican witch doctor. He had these powers, these occult powers, which is, of course, is a pretty scary thing.
Sure.
Now, I don't know why he felt the need to do this, but that night, he said he woke up around 2 or 3 in the morning, and it was the strangest thing. The room was totally dark, and there was something very strange about it, and he saw this figure floating in the air. And it was basically a Mexican witch doctor. He could feel his soul, his being pulled out of his body. And he didn't know what to do, and he called on Jesus, and the character, the creature, vanished just like that. And he's talked to other people since then, and this is not that unusual. So I mean, these are strange, you know, as a scientist, what do you do with something like this? But as a person who, you know, is telling what he experienced, it's a cautionary tale that there are spirits that might have a variety of different feelings about, you know, good and evil and what's appropriate.
Let's take a step backward for a moment. We both agree this exists. It's out there. You can tap into it. It's part of this existence. Let's talk about the divine creator for a moment. There is no way all of this could be put together by accident, by random, by just a roll of the dice. There's no way.
Probably true.
Is that the physicist talking? The physicist just said probably.
Well, you know, Einstein had his... the difficulty is that as a scientist that we're talking about areas that are beyond our training and even beyond our definition of what God is. We have to first agree on what God is. For me...
I don't think we can agree to that.
Probably not. For me, the best I can say is that I have met people... First of all, I believe that spirits exist. I believe that we have access to higher dimensional intelligence. We have guidance oftentimes of an intuitive type from higher dimensional beings who seem wiser than we are. And I've met people who seem possessed of a higher dimensional intelligence and a higher dimensional wisdom. So I can extrapolate from that to a universal source that's above all, you know. But that's about the best I could do.
I've got to believe that there is a higher power somehow. I just can't comprehend the fact that this was all an act of random, that there was chance. And even the fact, even if you believe in the Big Bang theory, and I have my questions about how that started.
Me too.
The fact is something did start. And that alone should tell you that there's something else going on here.
I agree with that. I think what I like is more the, what I guess I would call the Hindu or the yogic perspective.
Which is?
Well, that we're all here to learn. That we incarnate in the human form to learn. And there are these higher dimensional levels on which our consciousness resides in between incarnations. And so we make these paths up and then paths back. And we, each time, we sort of learn more lessons and become wiser. So
we're all Jonathan Livingston seagulls, aren't we?
Well, I mean, what I like about that is that even misfortunes and tragedies have a positive side, and that, you know, that we're all kind of getting better, you know, at our own rate as we do that.
Well, I don't know. It's a big picture.
You're asking tough questions here.
It is a big picture. Well, we're going to take questions next hour from listeners and also stories. I'd like them to share with us stories similar to the one where the two cars almost collided and they did not. We'll do that next. With Dr. Claude Swanson, our special guest tonight with his latest work, Life Force, I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on coasttocoastam.com. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com.